This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Place to Be Nation, welcome to episode 3 of Making Towns with Friends here on the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed. My name is Steve Williams, and this is a show just about various topics in the world of professional wrestling. This week, we will be talking about my time training to be a professional wrestler. Back in 2006 in Ohio Valley Wrestling. But before we get into it, let's talk about some of the other exciting shows on the various Place to Be feeds. Over on the Pop feed, after a two-year hiatus, Dadcast is back when JT and Don talk a variety of annoyances, including potty training, lying, Nickelodeon shows, and more. Russell and Sam deliver their Season 1 finale of 90s to Nothing with a look at Star Wars Episode 1, The Phantom Menace. On the Year in Pop, host Andy and Scott are joined by J. Arsenio D'Amato and Dr. G to discuss the news, music, and movies of 1975. Pop goes to the movies with Andy Atherton's review of the new live-action Aladdin. You know, I have not seen that yet, but I've heard some mixed reviews. I may or may not check that out. The hard-traveling fanboys continue Avengers Month with an installment of Longbook Hunters looking at New Avengers Volume 1 Breakout. And the NBA team dropped a double shot of episodes, including Gone Fishing Part 1 and an NBA Finals Preview Pod Blast. This Week in Sports also found the Cowboy and D'Amato running down the NBA Finals and breaking down the series between the Warriors and Raptors. Be sure to keep an eye on our social media feeds as the reboot of the Greatest Song of the 80s tournament is starting soon. And over on the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed. On the Place to Be podcast, Justin Scott and guest Jake Williams dive into the May 1989 Meadowlands House Show in episode 521. Then they are back with a double dose of Saturday night's main event from May and July of 1989 with host Peter Winson. In the sixth episode of Row 1, Seat 1, Ben Zani welcomes Daniel McAbey to talk music and his independent wrestling career. Scott Criscuolo, Nate Milton, and Steve Willey recap Double or Nothing and classic TNA on the newest edition of Main Event. And on PlaceToBeNation.com, check out Steve Riddle's countdown of the top 25 matches in TakeOver history. Also available on the site is the latest installment of PTBN's excellent WWE Network Adventure with an in-depth look at Mid-South Wrestling from May 26, 1984. And of course, check out our social media pages and message board at Bigelow34.proboards.com for information on joining our GWWE pay-per-view and TV match ever project. Get in on the conversation today and start researching your list. Now, back to our topic today, Steve Williams training in Ohio Valley Wrestling back in 2006. I've been asked for a while to speak on this, and I decided just to go ahead and make this a solo podcast. I wasn't sure if I could find someone who would want to ask the right kind of question, so I figured let's just do a stream of consciousness, Steve training to be a wrestler kind of show. First off, I was fortunate enough to be based in Louisville, Kentucky during my late teens, early 20s, which at the time was the hub of OVW, the developmental company for WWE at the time. I did not take advantage of this opportunity when I was younger and wanting to be a wrestler. By the time I got the ball rolling, I would have been 24 years old, married with a very small child. I think my daughter had just turned 1 when I started training. We were in a situation, looking back, I think my wife at the time probably did some kind of consolidation loan and had some fun money left over. So we decided that we're going to do something with that. She offered me up $500 with the intentions of me buying an Xbox 360, which was the hot new game system. And I decided instead to use that money toward wrestling training, which is something I'd always wanted to do. Even though I was not particularly athletic, you know, I had the passion. I just thought maybe if I hit the gym and actually learn how to do it, you know, I would make a go of it. At the time, $500 guaranteed you 3 months of training in the OVW system. I think now that barrier of entry, I think the price point is either $1,000 or $1,500 now for that same level of training. According to the website at the time, after the 3 months, they either would decide it wasn't for you, they would offer you the chance to re-enroll for another 3 months, or they would move you on to the next level, which was another $1,500 from there. So I liked that they didn't ask for $3,000 straight up like most wrestling schools would. There was the chance to get my feet wet, so to speak, and decide if it was going to be something for me. Now, once I started talking about this at work, I worked at a hospital at the time, it turned out that one of our maintenance guys was already in that program, and he was able to tell me that at the time, Mikey Mondo, Mikey of the Spirit Squad, he was the head trainer, but he had recently let that responsibility go because at the time the Spirit Squad were hot and heavy, about to enter their main event feud with DX. So obviously that superseded his need to train a bunch of Greenhorns in Louisville. And at that time, they weren't yet sure who they were going to get to replace him. It turns out it was a gentleman named Mario Bocara, who recently has been featured in TNA or Impact or whatever the hell they're called these days. He was the head trainer. When I put in the application, he was the one who called me back to get my details. He was wrestling NOVW as a lower card wrestler named Mo Sexton. And Paul Heyman was writing the television for OVW at the time. He would also sit in the Eagle's Nest type area and watch the classes and make recommendations and call people up to TV. One of those people ended up being Santino Marella, which led to all kinds of butterfly effect type stuff. So anyways, I was looking forward to working under Paul Heyman. You know, that was a dream come true for a young smart mark like me. However, he was pulled from OVW because the ECW relaunch was about to happen. In fact, before I heard from Mario, I took it upon myself to go to the Derby Park Expo 5, where they were doing a live OVW show, as well as showing the ECW One Night Stand 2 pay-per-view afterwards, to try to find Danny Davis myself and look for some answers. And that didn't work. He doesn't go to spot shows because he just sits back and counts his money. God bless him. Instead, I found Al Snow and Elijah Burke, and they were both very, very forthcoming and, you know, answered my questions for me. And the next day is when I finally heard back from Mo. So anyway, a week or so later, I show up to my training with a check for $500. And I'm told that, you know, because of the carny nature of the wrestling business and nobody trusts nobody, that check was no good here. I had to come back with either cash or a money order. So I scurried off to the Kroger's down the street and came back with my money order, and I was good to go. I was ready to start training after I filled out my paperwork. There was another guy who started with me, whose name I don't recall, but this kid was just a natural athlete, and it made the fact that I had led in my ass just it made it that much worse. That first day, we didn't do much. A lot of the other guys who were training had been there for a while, and they were teaching them basic mechanics of tag team wrestling, just some real simple psychology, and they had their fundamentals down pretty well. Toward the end of the class, they pulled some of the newer guys into the ring, and we basically learned how to hit the ropes, and that was pretty much it. The first day was hitting the ropes and locking up. The next day, we had our full slate of trainers there who were at the time. It was Mo, Seth Skyfire, who was under a developmental contract at the time, as well as the fella who would later become known as Sim Snuka or Deuce of the Deuce and Domino tag team, aka the camera guy who did not effectively catch The Undertaker at WrestleMania that, in 2009. So those were the guys training us, and there was a rotating crew of people in and out that we'll touch on as we progress here. That second day is when we learned how to take bumps. And for someone who's watched wrestling at that point for 25 years, my dumb ass just was not getting it. I thought I was doing it correctly, but you know how it is when you can't see yourself doing something. You know, it was very awkward. I was like jumping backwards and falling flat. They kept saying, no, it's like we're pulling a rug out from under you. And I just was not understanding what that meant. And finally, Seth, God bless him, Seth came up with the analogy that he said, pretend like the invisible woman is on the ceiling and you're trying to fuck her. And that did it. My hips popped right up and I made that flat back bump and nailed it. So, yeah, that was some of the early struggles. Among people in my early class, there was, as Hugo moves around here, there was one gentleman who did end up with a developmental deal. His name was Lupe. I believe he wrestled as Lupe Vizcarra and then later Lupe Martinez in Florida. He never made it to the main roster. He wasn't all that great, but he was built like a Adonis. This kid was handsome and great physique. And at the time, great physiques were way more important to your success in WWE than anything else. Right as I started, Alicia Fox joined our class. She and Barbie Blank, who became known as Kelly Kelly, apparently were signed at about the same time. And Barbie made it right to TV for the new ECW, and Alicia Fox, Victoria was her name, she was sent to developmental, sent first to us just to learn basic stuff. And then she ended up on the developmental roster for about 2 years before she made it up to television. She was a real sweetheart. I had all the time in the world for Alicia Fox. She was great. Something else, an early phenomenon that happened was the Divas search was hot and heavy that year. And as the girls would get eliminated from TV, the ones who were offered contracts were sent down to our beginners class. The first two were Amy, I think Zidian was her last name. She was on TV very briefly as Jimmy Wang Yang's the girlfriend. And also Maurice. I was one of the first people in class to make contact with Maurice. She ended up just standing in line behind me while we were doing drills. So I'm making small talk. Obviously, you got this beautiful French-Canadian woman behind me. And yeah, I won't say I was running game, but, you know, the opportunity's there. You're going to shoot your shot and see what happens. And she made her laugh a bit, and she hit me with the, "You remind me of a lot of my brother." And I realized at the time that, no, this is going nowhere. It's time to pack up your ball and leave. Had I known that Mike the Miz from the real world was going to end up in that position, I absolutely would have pressed on, guys. I would have made that happen for sure. But I digress. As far as the actual training itself goes, something that caught me off guard that second day was I kept forgetting to tuck the chin in taking back bumps. And I couldn't figure out that's what was happening. I just was very shaken a lot of the time. And I didn't realize that what was happening was the back of my head was hitting the mat. And it's just, you know, a canvas, a little bit of foam, and some plywood. And, you know, laid on top of some 2x4. So, yeah, it fucking hurts. You know, my brain was rattled. And I couldn't figure out what was going on. Yeah, that's what it was. Tuck your chin, kids. Even now, I think if I slipped and fell at the grocery, I think I could just instinctively throw my arms out and tuck my chin and take the bump safely. So the first week was just basic stuff. Like I said earlier, there were some guest trainers rotating in and out. And on week two, we had Shad from Crime Time. At the time, they were the Gangstars was the team name. It was Shad, and JTG at the time was known as the Neighborhoodie, which was a terrible name, but JTG was awesome. Shad was a very intimidating man. And you know, I don't say that begrudgingly. You're training people to be professional wrestlers. It's a tough business. You do want to weed out the weaker ones. He insisted on us. One of his first questions was, "Who's never taking the chop?" So then we all had to take our shirts off and let this big beast of a man just chop the shit out of us. And then we would lock up with him. I kept flinching on the lockup. And every time I flinched, Shad would slap me open hand in the ribs as hard as he could as a correction to get me to not do it again. It probably took 6 or 7 times of this happening before I was able to keep my eyes open on the lockup. I was so frazzled from getting slapped in the midsection repeatedly that I somehow managed to cut Shad's eye, the corner of his eye, with my pinky finger on the lockup. I mean, how the hell do you poke somebody in the eye on a collar and elbow? But I was nervous, and like I said, I was already unathletic as it was. I was making friends left and right. At the end of the classes, we would do some kind of a drill. It would be a different kind of drill every time. My favorite of these was we would match up according to weight class and do like legitimate amateur style wrestling. It was a deal where, you know, the person who would start on the bottom in the old referee position, if you will, that person, the goal was to break free from the other person's grasp. And that is an area where I excelled just based on my line of work. I've worked in psychiatric hospitals my entire adult life. Therefore, I found myself in situations where I've had to take down bigger and stronger people. And in those situations, you find out a lot about leverage. So I was able to just kick ass on that thing. You know, I wasn't the biggest or the strongest or the toughest or the meanest, but damn it, I could hold you down until somebody else got there. So that drill really played to my strengths. I was happy as hell when we got to do that. But after the Shad Gaspard slapping the shit out of me incident, and again, I hold no ill will toward him. I shook his hand afterwards. He was very complimentary. After that, I ended up having to miss the next week of training. We had to move some stuff around the house 1 week, and then the next day I was just tired and frankly lazy and just didn't want to go. So I followed up the next week, and it was rather uneventful for a while. Some of the faces are rotated through as guest trainers. Sean Spears, Ty Dillinger, he spent a lot of time with us. He was a big help, really intelligent guy, really helpful. One day we would go after the people who were under developmental contracts. Their class would file out usually before we got there, but theirs ran over one day. And for some reason, I don't know what happened in the class to trigger this, but a young Cody Rhodes was ordered to stay over and join our class for the first hour to get a better grasp of fundamentals. So he did. He hit the ropes with us and did our little piddly drills and just real nice, humble guy. I can't say enough good things about young Cody Rhodes. This is a good opportunity to touch on some of the people who were in the developmental program that we worked with on a fairly regular basis, because part of our duties were to, we had class on Mondays and Tuesdays, and then Wednesdays we would help out with the TV tapings. So some of the people in the developmental at the system at the time were, like I said, Chad and JTG, Seth Skyfire, Sean Spears, Cody Rhodes, Elijah Burke. There was Bradley J. J. Bradley. I can't remember which name he went by. Brad Bradley at times. I believe he's working the ROH dojo now, if I'm not mistaken. Obviously, the Spirit Squad guys were up and down. And quite a few guys who just never made it to TV. Casey James, Idol Stevens, the later known as Damian Sandow. He was in the system at the time. So yeah, we got to work with some good people. And Al Snow took over the booking of the television show after Paul Heyman left. And working with him was Greg Gagne, whatever the fuck you want to call him. Later fired for, among other things, sexual harassment of some of the ladies. So, yeah, go Greg, some bitch. Anyway, these were just some of the people in and out. One of the highlights of my time was when Joey Mercury, Joey Matthews, who had been pulled off TV in May and I believe sent to rehab, but it's not one of those things you're going to ask about. He was sent down to OVW to help work off some of the rust, and he stepped in to become one of our trainers. And Joey is just brilliant when it comes to this wrestling stuff. Yeah. When you're that young in the business, you're thinking things in, 1, 2, maybe 3 step sequences, whereas Joey is a type, you'll be on step 2 and he'll already be calling step 6, 7, 8. He'll make you think ahead. Mo told us a great little sidebar one time about how he was working Joey, and Joey whips him into the ropes and just whispers in his ear, watch the backdrop. So Mo comes back and is expecting, to be launched off in a backdrop. And instead he sees Joey set up for a clothesline. And just instinctively he knew, all right, I'm going to duck the clothesline. And then he's coming off the other direction and there's an elbow he's got to duck. So he knows at some point in that sequence that there is a backdrop coming. And that's just Joey. Joey is a thinking man's wrestler and athletic and smart. And I have all the time in the world for Joey. At one point, we were on a break, and I'm standing in the ring talking to somebody. And Joey, just from out of nowhere, just took 2 good steps and drop-kicked me right in the face. It didn't, it was a work kick. I felt it make contact, but it's not like he was trying to injure me. And just instinctively, I took a bump for him. And he got up and clapped and called everybody over. and made a point to say that, you know, always think on your feet when you're in the ring. You never know what's going to happen. You know, I grabbed this kid, I dropkicked him. He didn't know it was coming, but he sold. Be prepared when you're in the ring to ad lib. And I thought that was a cool little pat myself on the back kind of moment. I said that nobody that was in the class with us really made it to TV, but there were various people who were sent to work with us. One of those people was at the time wrestling as Atlas DeBone. He ended up getting called up to ECW television as Atlas Ortiz, and then later Ricky Ortiz, with the Ricky Rowdy towels, this big oafish son bitch. Now, Ricky was great. Real name is Rich. Just a big wall of a man. I mean, taking one look at him, it was no surprise why this guy got signed. He was a former football player, big wild hair. He had charisma. And I thought for sure he was going to make it in wrestling, but he was a little bit of a Tom McGee. You know, he just didn't grasp a lot of the simple concepts as far as putting together a match. But he was a sweetheart of a man. We had somebody get hurt in our training one time, and Rich, you know, stopped everything, went over and checked on him, made sure he was safe, got him out of harm's way. Yeah, Rich was an all-around good guy. And speaking of injuries, you know, of course in wrestling, you're going to get any number of injuries. Probably the worst one that I had was doing an O'Connor or an Oklahoma roll. Yeah, an Oklahoma roll, I believe it's called. Similar to a La Mahi Shark cradle. Guys on all fours. I jump over, and the idea is to cradle the head and the leg on the way over and end up in a pinning position. I somehow just completely neglected to hook the head. And in doing so, that changed the entire trajectory of my roll to where it was no longer a roll. I ended up going face first into the mat, jamming my face. The rest of my body kept going. And the gentleman I was in the ring with didn't realize this happened. So he rolled right over me with my face still on the mat, my neck hyperextended. Yeah, I popped right up, almost like a drunk person trying to prove he's okay. And Seth realized I was kind of fucked right away. Sat me down for a few minutes until they were sure that I was going to be good to go. Maybe not the best story to tell on air with all the concussion protocol stuff, but I was not concussed. I was just stupid. The next day, I realized I couldn't turn my head either way. At my hospital job, a girl that I worked with actually like rubbed the kinks out of my neck, and that really loosened things up to where I can move. So I don't think there was any actual spinal cord damage. I think it was just some inflammation there. I still have a very small knot on the left side of my neck from that. So you're training to wrestle. Every month, we had what we called inside amateur shows. On the tickets, they said Future Talent Showcase. It was once a month. It was our chance to wrestle in front of a paying crowd. And it was people who wanted to see us because we would sell the tickets ourselves. Whoever sold the most tickets went over in the main event working against Mario, usually in a tag situation. I had started training at the beginning of June. By September, I figured I was ready for that first match. Right after I made that decision, Mario either broke his leg or tore his ACL. Something happened to where he ended up just dropping out as our trainer altogether and going back home. At that point, Tank Toland, who was had a very brief stint on SmackDown as a member of the Dix tag team, he took over as our head trainer. And Tank is another guy that I have all the time in the world for. He was so nice to us and patient and showed us a lot of stuff. And he would start off with, all right, well, what do you guys want to learn today? He wanted to make it as fun as possible. And given the ragtag group of athletes he was given, oh, God bless him for stepping into that job. Yeah, Tank was great. He told us some stories of, you know, kind of how things went as far as the demise of the Dix. The other guy in the team, Chad, had apparently been taking classes on how to become a stripper because it was like a Chippendales type gimmick. And Chad was kind of aloof. Like, Chad would come around sometimes too. But Chad, I guess, had recorded himself dancing like this. and was so excited to show his coworkers in the WWE locker room. So it starts off with him showing it to one guy, and the way Tank explained it, it turned into, Benoit, come over, check this out. And at the time, he's telling us this, Chris Benoit was still alive. He said that Benoit always had a coffee stir in his mouth that he would just nervously chew on. And he just has this look of amusement on his face. And it turns to, hey, Taker, come over and look at this. And once The Undertaker doesn't respect you, you're done in that locker room. Rumor is they ended up getting into a fist fight on a road trip, and they were both let go. But anyways, they were still based in Louisville, so they would both pop in every so often to train. Tank was not going to do the beginners, or the amateur class with us, but still I decided just to go in and sell my tickets and get my spot on the show, and I ended up selling 21 tickets, so that's $210 into the coffers of the company, of which I got paid zero. I show up early to the class, to the show, my very first show. I want to make a good impression. I find out that Rip Rogers is running this thing. Rip was the head trainer and still is, I believe, for the intermediate class. I walk up on him, introduce myself, let him know who I am, let him know how many tickets I sold, and he just chuckled, said, well, kid, you're going over tonight. I guarantee you that much. So, of course, in wrestling etiquette, I went around and shook everyone's hand I could possibly find in this strange new environment. And then the card was put together, and I was not in the main event despite having sold the most tickets, but I was put over. I was the fourth or fifth match on the card, teaming with Lucky Electro and Jack O'Lantern against the newly christened team of the Mobile Homers. The Mobile Homers were Adam Revolver, Dewey, and the newest member of the team was Ted the Trailer McNaylor. We had known him as the Man Beast. He had been working referee gigs on the TV tapings forever. He was a good kid. He later had a big, kind of high profile match with Brian Alvarez on a TV taping a year or so later. He was great. The guys I was teaming with, Lucky Electro, is a kid named Leo who ended up moving to Florida and I believe picked up some wrestling down there too. And the other guy's name was, Sonny? Sonny was the kid's name, Jack O'Lantern. It was exactly what you think it is. Kind of a tubby guy with an orange shirt, painted his face like a pumpkin, threw out candy to the kids, that kind of thing. And I'd be remiss if I didn't mention my prep for this match included. I decided I was going to go shirtless and tan. So first I burned myself, so that's fun. And then I do have a bit of chest hair, so I decided that needed to be taken care of. I waxed, and that had okay results. Then I decided to shave it as it came back in, and I ended up with so much chest irritation, I looked like Daniel Bryan at the end of that Greatest Royal Rumble match. Just my chest looking a mess. There was no way I was going to go out shirtless like that, so I ended up just wearing black and red long tights and a red muscle shirt for my debut match. So we befriend the Mobile Homers. We sit around, kind of shoot some ideas. They realize it's my first match, and I can almost see the disappointment on their face. They ask, what can you do? And I'm like, well, not much. Like I can't do the the Oklahoma roll, but I can do a couple basic things, atomic drops, drop kicks, that kind of thing. So they actually made me do a drop kick in the ring to prove I can get the height. Then we were off to the races. We decided on a finisher that nobody could fuck up. A Stone Cold Stunner was my finisher of my first match. So we get out there. I had brought a entrance music, which was going to be Gnarls Barkley's Crazy was going to be my song. Once we got there and I realized I was on a team with two other guys, even though we were all about the same experience level, Electro had been wrestling. This was his third amateur show, I think. So as the most experienced person, he was the vet, so we had to defer to him. And he picked a song called To Be Loved. Now this was September 21st, 2006. About 3 or 4 weeks later, Monday Night Raw used this same song as their opening music. So he lost it, obviously. He couldn't come out to the Raw music. So he was bummed because he had apparently spent months looking for that song and made his decision, and then fucking big corporate Vince McMahon comes and steals it out from under the little guy. So we have our match. Mobile Homers come out first. And it sounds insane knowing I only sold 21 tickets, but like the pop when we came out caught me off guard. Like there was an instant outpouring of cheers for, I guess, all my people sat in the same section. So that really helped concentrate the sound. And then other people started picking up on it, you know, thinking we must be a big deal, which we weren't. We weren't shit. We were three rookies coming out to be put over. But yeah, that was awesome. Because I had so little gear, I wore a homemade hoodie that I bought from eBay years ago that just said Psychopathic on the front, and not to Psychopathic Records. Shout out to ICP. And that was my ring jacket. Nobody had told me like what to do with my gear, so I ended up just literally throwing my jacket on the floor in our corner because nobody came to get it, and I just picked it up and carried it with me after the match. Anyways, we had the match. It's nothing too big. They get the heat on Jack O'Lantern, and I get the hot tag, and we had the idea that I was going to do an atomic drop to Man Beast, and he swung wildly. I ducked, and he was ready for that atomic drop, and I was not. He just launched his ass in the air, and I was off balance, wound up crumbling like a sack of shit under him. But we got together, hit the atomic drop, make a cover. Dewey comes and kicks me in the head. Man Beast picks me up for a body slam, and I do the old float over behind him, turn around, bam, kick in the gut, Stone Cold Stunner, 1, 2, 3. The crowd goes mild. We did our little celebration, got the hell out of Dodge, and not knowing, like I said, the customs of wrestling yet, when you walk through the curtain at the OVW arena, there's just like a janitor's door right there that you walk through to get to the back, and there's a room right there with a television that you can walk through to get to the back, kind of the more open dressing area. And I walked back just to put my jacket away. Rip Rogers stopped me immediately and said, "Hey, those guys put you over like $1 million. You better make sure you thank them the second they come back." So, you know, he was right. I just didn't know shit. I didn't know any better. So I made sure to stop and meet them at the curtain and shake all their hands and hug and thank them profusely for doing everything they did, because they could have really been assholes about it, but they were up in the air for us quite a bit. Man Beast put together some spots to shine me up early on, that we did a deal where I backed him off into the corner. And, you know, we did the, you know, you have five to break. So as I'm letting go, he had tripped me up, like hooked his leg behind mine to shove me, and then dragged me off to like he was going to be able to work on me. And then I did a quick roll up, an arm drag, you know, come on, baby, fire up that horse shit, which still works in the self, by the way, but it's not going to work most places. But anyway, they did a great job putting together that match for us. So of course we stay over to help clean up everything and, you know, leave the place better than you found it, that kind of thing. I ended up only wrestling in OVW for a few more weeks after that. I did start with Rip's advanced class. However, my schedule changed at work, so I ended up not being available for those classes that he was holding. In particular, the weekends were an issue. Most hospital jobs require you to work every other weekend, which is something I had to do. Therefore, I ended up just gracefully backing out. I had a talk with Tank. And he offered up ring time. He said, "Hey, anytime you want to come in, just roll around, man. Don't worry about money. You know, if I'm here, we got you." So I did that a couple times over the next few months. It turns out not long after I left, the lack of physical ability on a lot of these kids was just becoming too much to overcome. And they instituted the old style calisthenics at the beginning of the class, which I was shocked we weren't doing to begin with, just to make sure everybody was physically capable of doing a lot of the spots we were asked to do. So I heard a lot of whining over that, but I think it was the right thing to do. I wish I'd been around for that. Some notable things about the class. There was one guy who would drive down by every 5 hours, every Tuesday, from Chicago to train. And sadly, he never really made it in, as far as the wrestling business, because that's a level of dedication most people just would not have. I was there when the first Crime Time vignette aired on Raw. The next night, we showed up to class, and a lot of the contract guys were still there. So, you know, everybody was jovial for Shad and Jason to know they were getting called up. So that was cool to kind of be a part of that. I was there for CM Punk's last night in OVW. He was scheduled to wrestle Skyfire for the OVW title. They did a thing where Skyfire got injured by Charles Evans. And they didn't know who he was going to wrestle. So he ended up wrestling a gentleman named Chet the Jet, who was in developmental for a long time. And he put over the babyface Strong. After the matches, Al Snow would get everyone together and do a little speech, kind of, you know, this is what worked, this is what didn't, that kind of thing. And then he would call somebody up to, they called it Send Us Home. And because it was Punk's last night, everyone assumed it would be him. And instead, Al pulled one of the beginner guys up to do a promo and encouraged him to keep it going. So the guy is just rambling on, and it's clearly the shits. And the WWE contracted people are peeling off left and right. Punk was the first one to go, like he was throwing a fit. But it turns out it was all a ruse. He came up later from behind the guy, and he had a kendo stick with him. And he just blasted the shit out of this poor kid, took the mic, and then he sent us home. So, yeah, that was a fun little thing. Another thing is that during the summer, they would do the OVW Six Flags Summer Sizzler series, is what they called it, I believe, where every 2 weeks we would have big, almost pay-per-view style shows at the local Six Flags theme park. That summer, Dusty Rhodes came down, so we got to meet the Dream. He and Cody wrestled as a team. Ted DiBiase was in and out a lot of times because, well, there's no real reason I can think of for Ted being there. I think he was just there as a talent scout. Jimmy Snuka was there because Deuce was there. He actually, after he did his spot, I was working the concession stand, like the gimmick table, if you will, and the locker room door was directly opposite that table. And he just wandered right out of that locker room door barefoot and walked into the parking lot, and we never saw him again. So who the hell knows? You know, if he wasn't dead, I'd be sure he was still wandering the countryside as we speak. Yeah, just cool little things like that. John Cena ended up working the last show of the summer, as he liked to do. He would come down and work one show every summer for us. I did not have access to him. And actually, the next summer is when he came down and worked Sean Spears, Ty Dillinger, at the end of a torrential downpour. So, yeah, that's a hoot. Anyway, after my OVW experience, I kind of was pitter-pattered around some of the local. At the time, Louisville just had a real shit local indie scene. I wrestled a battle royal at the fair in the worst part of town. My last weekend really in the business ended up being the same weekend that Chris Benoit died. Those incidents were unrelated, I would say, you know, but I had worked the little piddly Portland fair, and then I drove up to Dayton, Ohio. I had Tank Toland by this point was working shots for ROH. I had messaged Gabe Sapolsky through the ROH message board at the time to say, hey, I'm in training under Tank. I'm in Louisville. Anything I can do to help and just get my face seen, I would love to do it. So he responded with, well, I don't know if we'll need help before the show, but we'll definitely need help after the show. Find Shane Hagedorn for further instruction. I'm like, all right, great. It turns out that was kind of a brushing me off kind of thing, because they need help after every show. Like, they'll literally take anybody out of the crowd to help tear down an ROH show at that time. And I didn't realize that Tank had been hurt working a spot with the Briscoes in New England. His shoulder was just completely fucked. So when Gabe asked him about me, you know, Tank was all gimmicked up and had no recollection of who I was. It wasn't until he saw me at the show that he realized, you know, oh, it was you. Okay, great. But yeah, he vouched for me there, and I was able to work out in the ring a little bit and help set up and tear down. Made some great contacts that weekend. Chris Hero was a great, great helpful person. Pelé Primo was very helpful. Shane Hagedorn, of course. There were a lot of good hands around, people to talk to or learn from. When I went to introduce myself to Nigel McGuinness, he was in the middle of, I guess there had been an ongoing rib thing with him not wearing underwear. So he was actually pulling down his pants to show that he was wearing Calvin Klein's as I extended my hand out to him. So that was a little bit of an embarrassing and awkward situation. And that night ended up being the night that Austin Aries came back to the company after having been away at TNA for a bit. Once we made it through that night without me leaking that information of seeing him around, Gabe, found me after the show and thanked me for my help and invited me to Chicago the next night. Something came up in my personal life where I couldn't make it. But anyway, I thought I made some good contacts there. Of course, that was Friday night, and that Monday, we found out about the Benoit thing. So I'm kind of down on wrestling in general, really kind of thinking about, is this something I want to pursue? Fast forward to September 15th of 2017, and I reach out to Hagedorn again to let him know that, hey, I'd like to come to Chicago I was planning on just coming as a fan either way, for the big ladder match between the Briscoes and Kevin Steen and El Generico. So, hey, if you need help, I would love to come up. And he gave me the green light to go ahead. Yeah. So I left my house early. Like I said, Chicago is 5 hours away. So I left at 7 or 8 in the morning so I would get there in time to help set up. Ended up running into Claudio Cesaro at Subway beforehand. And we sit and eat and everything's good. And talk with him and Hero and having ourselves a good time. I come to the building and Hagedorn sees me and kind of has this look of panic on his face. He says, oh man, I'm sorry. I forgot to tell you. I got the word from Gabe that no outside people are allowed today. It's strictly because they were doing the Age of the Fall debut. They wanted to make absolutely sure no spoilers got out. So they sent me away until bell time. So that really left a bad taste in my mouth. I ended up just kind of being a sourpuss about it and just saying, fuck it. I don't really want to pursue this anymore. It was just one thing too many. And on top of that, with the WWE's hiring practices at the time, as I said, Barbie Blank and Alicia Fox got hired because Johnny Ace liked the way they looked in a catalog. I believe it was a bikini catalog of some sort. So those types of people were getting looks. And Lupe, who sucked in my class, was getting a look. But Nigel McGuinness and the Briscoes and Brian Danielson and Chris Hero and Claudio and those types were not getting looks at the time. So I just saw it as a business I would not be able to break into and make any real money. As a father and a husband at the time, I just decided it was best for everybody's best interest if I just walked away. And that was it. I have not been inside of a wrestling ring since the summer of 2017. Funnily enough, I probably know more wrestlers now as a wrestling Twitter fan than I ever did when I was actually wrestling, which is kind of ridiculous. But hey, whatever. Go figure. I've been rambling long enough. I think I'll go ahead and wrap this up. If you want to follow me on Twitter, you can do so at SongsWithSteve. Also, if you're not familiar with my other podcast work here on the various feeds, I recommend checking out Songs with Friends on the Place to Be Nation pop feed. Once every 2 weeks, myself and Kelly, we will break down song lyrics. Sometimes we get sentimental, sometimes we get ridiculous, just depending on where the day takes us. We just dropped an episode the day I recorded this, actually, where we covered Bob Seger's Night Moves. And Semi-Charm Life was the Third Eye Blind Semi-Charm Life. That was a fun episode. And like I said, we do that about every 2 weeks here on the pop feed. As far as making towns of friends, coming up in the next few weeks, I've been promising 2002 talk with Dr. Shahid Abdul-Hadi for a while. I didn't realize it was Ramadan, so I decided to let him get through that so he can be the best he can be. We'll be dropping that content soon. Until next time, I will see you down the road.